Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder to ask a live question, please press star one on your telephone keypad. Our first question comes from the line of June Halper from Fairlawn, New Jersey. Please proceed with your question.
Willie, let me tell you, that was fantastic. What a great, great presentation. It's comforting to hear that other nurses are going through what we all are going through all over the country, particularly with the challenges with insurance. But I was just wondering, what if, speaking of the other way, what if you have a patient that you're prior authorizing a medication and you see that it's not working and you realize that you're spending, or the insurance coverage is spending, a lot of money on a medicine that's still not, you know, effective, and yet the patient wants to hang in there? How do you handle that, you know, without destroying the patient's hopes, and yet you're advocating for what's right in terms of, you know, the cost to society and the cost to, you know, everybody else?
I think in a situation like this is when we need to get our physician involved. If the medication is truly not helping the patient, I think the physician needs to sit down with the patient. We need to talk to the physician and get him to sit down with the patient and explain that, you know, the medication is really not helping. Let's see if there's something else that will be more effective for you in this particular issue.
Yeah, how do you help the patient, though, deal with that loss? I mean, that's a real major, you know, we've seen that a lot lately, you know, where people are actually secondary progressive and whatever the disease-modifying therapy just doesn't work. You know, so the physician tells the patient and then they fall apart. You know, what kind of resources do you have, or do you have in your community? I know it's getting tougher where we are because our MS society has merged into one large chapter, and, you know, many counselors, you know, just don't want to see our patients because of reimbursement issues. How do you handle that where the patient needs some counseling and support?
It's counseling, that's a tough issue because, you know, where we are, it's kind of tough to get patients to that facility in our own institution. So we have to look to see what else is out there in the community for the patient. If there's anything on the public health, or if there are other agencies out there that can provide some counseling services for the patient to help them get through this tough situation that they're facing. And then, you know, we do a lot of hand-holding. You know, we try to talk to the patient and to try to, you know, help them see, you know, okay, we have some lemons. Let's see if we can put some lemon in it, some sugar in it, and sweeten it up some. Make some lemonade.
Well, if I ever get sick, Willie, I'm coming down there for you. So much. Really, really good. I hope you feel better.
Thank you.
Thank you, June. Okay, let's move on to any other comments in the queue.
Yes, we have three in queue. Our next comes from the line of Amy Perrin Ross from Chicago, Illinois. Please proceed with your question.
Thank you so much, Willie. This was just a wonderful presentation. I echo what June said, and I'd like to say how helpful the case studies are because they really put in a real perspective and a vision for me of how we can think about nurses as advocates. And, you know, one of the things that you talked about in the beginning as you stated your objectives was, you know, how to help patients be advocates for themselves. And I think that that's really important that we as nurses don't assume the role of taking over and doing everything for our patients, but we need to empower them to be advocates for themselves. And I'd just like to know if you have experiences in your practice where you're doing more of that kind of stuff these days, or patients are really simply being dependent upon their healthcare workers?
Sometimes if there's something that we know that they can do and they can make some calls, we try to encourage them, you know, to call and get some information, you know, at least start the process. For example, we had a patient whose disease-modifying agent had been changed to a, she could no longer use the local drugstore, which she wanted to use. She was resistant to changing. And she said, well, I said, well, what you need to do, you need to call and see which specialty pharmacy they say you have to use under this insurance. So after she did that, I said, now what you need to do is you need to call and you need to enroll yourself. And then once you do that, then I can call any prescription. So, because otherwise, if I had done all this legwork, then I would have had to give them her enrollment information and all of this information. So she did it. So she called me back and she said, this is the number you need to call any prescription to. So when I called, all I had to do was call it in. I didn't have to give them her demographics and all of that, which they require. So if it's things that they can do, we need to let them do it. Because otherwise, they will have us doing everything for them.
Absolutely. Very, very good point. And that case illustration is quite helpful because I definitely agree with you. We need to help empower our patients to be advocates for themselves. But I definitely think that's one of our roles is to educate them as to how they can empower themselves. And it certainly sounds like that's what you did by giving her specific instructions. First you do this and then you do that. So thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Amy. Great, great discussion point. Let's move on to the next question in the queue.
Certainly. Our next question in the queue comes from the line of Beverly Layton from Birmingham, Alabama. Please proceed with your question.
Thanks so much. And I just want to give a very nice talk, Willie, that you've had tonight. As a coworker with Willie, I can tell you that she's so balanced with our patients and families and has a great skill in kind of sorting out some of the issues sometimes that a patient and a family member when friction is in the clinic setting when we're there with our patients. And Willie, I'd like you to talk a little bit about some maybe your experience or how you kind of diffuse the situation when you're there with that patient and a family member and the patient maybe has a little cognitive problems but still rather intact in knowing what they would like to do, especially from a standpoint of independence and how you can help sort that out with that patient and their loved one.
We have to discuss safety. You know, what's safe? What's safe for the patient? If they need, and sometimes pride gets in the way with the patient, and sometimes family members are just kind of in denial, and maybe not deny. Maybe denial is not the right word. Maybe lack of knowledge is maybe a better word. They haven't been coming with the patient, or they're just kind of they don't live with the patient, and they just kind of come to provide transportation. So we have to talk about safety. You know, if you fall, you know, if you have walking issues and you fall and you break a hip, then that's going to set you back more. So it's better to use something and try to get the safety issues addressed on the front end rather than trying to get them addressed on the back end when you have more of a problem with mobility or more of a problem with disability that has been brought on by something that has happened because of an unsafe action. So, you know, we have to kind of get them to agree about safety or whatever that issue is, whether it's safety or nutrition or whatever it is on the front end rather than having to try to deal with it on the back end.
Right. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Bev. Okay, Doug, let's move to the next question in the queue.
Certainly. Just as a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, it is star one to ask a live question. Our next question comes from the line of Jen Smirka. Please proceed with your question.
Thanks, Doug. Hi, Willie. Hi, Lori. Great job, Willie. I was listening to your discussion, I was thinking, you know, so many points that you brought up are definitely the things that we do in our day-to-day operation. And I just wanted to ask you, as well as the rest of the group, I had a very really kind of frightening and upsetting situation occur actually 2 weeks ago with a patient. And I just wanted to ask our experienced nurses, our seasoned nurses, if they've heard of this before, what they would recommend. Willie, if you have any ideas. So I'm working with a patient, and she's had longstanding MS, has MRIs that are all of her objective evidence point to the fact that she is truly disabled. She has significant brainstem issues and cognitive issues, but she still is able to walk with minimal assistance. She's been on disability now for 2 years with Hartford, and after the 2 years, they are reinvestigating her case. And she had come in 4 weeks ago with shingles and worsening MS symptoms, and we determined that she actually had shingles, and she was telling me it's because she's so stressed out because she's being followed. And she knew she was being followed was that there was a videotape sent to her home that was supposed to go to actually the Hartford Life Insurance, but apparently the private investigator who was hired by Hartford accidentally sent her the tape and not Hartford. And so when she and her husband played the tape, it was actually a videotape of her doing things like going to the grocery store, on the soccer field, watching her children, actually videotaping her in her own yard with her children. You know, as you can imagine, incredibly violating to her privacy and just a sense of fear that she's being watched. So as it turned out, 2 weeks ago, a package lands at our desk, and it's actually from the Hartford, and they have scripted and included the videotape that they sent her, asking us, my associate and myself, to comment on what we see on the videotape, and does she still actually qualify for her disability? And I was so taken back. Isn't that horrendous? I was so taken back.
That's awful. That's not legal at all.
Well, apparently, it's something that's going on because other patients, it's also happening with. And another patient who's very involved with the National MS Society told me that Hartford is actually notorious for having investigators and for following patients. And so I also question the legality of that. But I was just wondering, as nurses as a whole, as, even as a group, if the IOMSN, if there's something that we should be doing as a group, you know, and kind of advocating more on a legal level for our patients.
And it sounds like an invasion of a patient's privacy, or anybody's privacy for that matter.
Yes.
So that's a good question. Let's throw that out to the group. Willie, did you want to add
something? Did you say she had some cognition problems?
She does, and she's actually seen, we've had her do full neuropsychological evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have all of the supportive evidence. And more or less, we drafted a letter, kind of a scathing letter in response to this. My associate and I, who's a physician, just stating that we really felt that this was absolutely unjustified and that all of her objective evidence is supportive of the fact that she has MS, she has a disability, and that, in our opinion, that this was beyond the scope of reason and that all of our medical records should have supported this and have, and that this, in our opinion, was, you know,
mm-hmm.
We were both blown away, and my associate's been in practice for 35 years, and he hadn't heard of this. But apparently what the patient, another patient who I said was involved with the National MS Society, said it's all over the patient blogosphere that that Hartford, especially when you come up on that 2 years from having disability, when they're reviewing cases, that they're notorious for employing investigators. So I was just curious if anyone else, because I have to be honest, I've never heard of this when I worked in New York or North Carolina. This is the first time I've heard of it, and I find it so alarming.
I haven't heard of it with our patients yet, but I think somebody somewhere need to, maybe I don't know if the MS organizations or someone should, and you know, maybe it's addressed the invisible symptoms of multiple sclerosis, the things you know that patient, the issues that patient has that we can't see, because you know, truly, like the situation that you've mentioned, you know, you can't see that a person is cognitively impaired just by passing by looking at them, because they look fine. But you know, those are things that you can pick up on when you're more closely related to them. So I think that those invisible symptoms of MS need to be spoken to, you know, the cognition, fatigue, things like that, to kind of get those out in the open, that these are things that can be disabling as well as the inability to walk or use your hands or vision problems.
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead, Jen.
No, I was just going to say, I wanted to know if, like, June or Amy, if anybody had heard about this before.
Right. Let's put that question out there to our audience. If anybody has, I personally haven't heard of this either, so this is something that I was totally not aware of. Doug, would you like to maybe go to the next question in the queue?
Certainly. Our next question in the queue comes from the line of Patricia Pagnotta from Orlando, Florida. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, Willie, this is a great presentation. I want to say that first off, and I really appreciate that you put this together, having a cold and getting through this. So thank you.
Thank you.
to Jen's point, here in Orlando, I haven't seen this in our MS population, but I have seen this in many other situations. I mean, I've seen it with persons who talk about work injuries and with car accidents, that when they are out in public, that they actually have lawyers that run around and videotape them and whatnot. And I have heard of persons who have had this in mental health cases where they have been followed by different persons. So, but I haven't heard it in multiple sclerosis, and I haven't heard it with many of our other chronic disease states. I mean, I have had persons who have tried to go for disability who have epilepsy or who have migraines, and that's usually shot down by us. But in addition to that, they do have people, lawyers and things, that go looking for that. One of the things that I do for persons when we're going for disability is I put them through functional capacity testing. And I very specifically ask our rehab persons to evaluate them on repetitive activities, the things that, like, we all know persons' fatigue and weakness and things come into be. So I have them go for this testing when they're at not their best, and have the physical therapist really put them through as many type of things that they can to reproduce their work environment. And oftentimes that's helpful, and again, along with neuropsychological testing in documenting these issues for some of our MS patients, that, you know, for an hour a day they look great.
I think that's a great idea, Patricia. And, you know, any time during the day, I mean, if they can translate it into their working day, how fatigued that they can get, would you have your physical therapist do that for you?
I do. And our physical therapists have been very good at being able to articulate that. And they have a whole, I mean, I don't even understand. I can't tell you that I understand the process. But they have a whole method of dealing with this and documenting it in what's acceptable for a functional capacity test and is translatable between all persons in the work environment. And evidently the government looks at how they rate these things, but they do take into account what this person does and what physical activity is required, and they reproduce that to the best of their ability. And most of the time they're able to give them a score that puts them right where our assessment puts them as far as not being able to function in their work environment. The problem comes back when the employer then decides, well, I'm going to try to, you know, create a different work environment. And we know that doesn't work.
Uh-huh. Hmm. So sometimes I guess it just comes down to the evaluations and to specifically documenting correctly.
Right.
But, you know, the issue we've had with that is who pays for it. Those questions are asked a lot on disability applications. Like insurance won't pay for it, or the patient doesn't have the money to pay for it. So that's the issue we have been faced with it.
Patricia, how long does it take him to do a functional capacity testing? It would be one visit, wouldn't it?
It would be one visit unless the, you know, obviously if the patient can't get through it, that's even better. But somebody who is not severely debilitated, it can take 4 to 6 hours.
To do it. And would they do it all at one sitting or have them come back probably?
No, they try to get it all done at once.
Oh, done at one time. Okay. All right. Willie, is there anything else you wanted to add to that?
Not to that, but I would like to ask a question if anybody out there have had situations, you know, I talked about, you know, the who wins. If anybody have had situations where, I think we talked about it early on too, but other instances where the patient lost and the nurse lost. We were trying to be an advocate for the patient, and it just didn't work.
It didn't work either way, one way or another. Okay, let's open up the questions, the queue for that. Doug?
There are no other questions in the queue at this time.
Okay. So I'm sure that if we all kind of think about it, that there have been situations where it just hasn't worked out for both of us, for the nurse and you also brought up in your discussion, Willie, earlier about sometimes the nurse does have to let go.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the nurse, I mean, you do what you can do, utilize as many resources that you have possible, and in some ways you end up at a dead end.
Right, yeah, sometimes you do. You end up, it just doesn't work because the insurance is not going to budge. So, you know, we can't make them, and, you know, we've stated our case, and, you know, they say no, then we just have to let the patient that the insurance has denied it. And, you know, they said they're going to call them or they're going to complain to somebody. So, you know, that's when they can start doing whatever they need to do to advocate for change for the population as a whole. Because there may be somebody else out there who may have that same issue.
Oh, definitely, definitely. So anyone out there in our listening audience have any situations where the patient and the nurse both lost?
We do have two in queue before you ask that question, Lori.
Okay. All right.
Our
well,
first comes
ahead.
From the line of June Halper from Fairlawn, New Jersey. Please proceed with your question.
I'm back again, but I just wanted to say, Willie and Lori, you know, one of the things I guess we all have to recognize, there are situations where we all lose when we've done all we can, and just happened recently to me where we put a whole bunch of services in with the patient. She's a woman I know since she was like 16, and her mother died of advanced MS, and despite all that everybody told her when she first was diagnosed, oh, you're not going to look the same as your mother, you'll be fine, and she was on all the DMTs we could throw at her. The woman now just had pneumonia and was intubated, and talk about losses. I mean, no matter what we did, and believe me, we threw the kitchen sink at her. That's, I think, the worst kind of loss, and that's, I guess, of all the things that happen to me when I'm working in MS, is that's like the worst. You know, when you look at it the other way, when you've done everything you can, and the biggest loss can occur, no matter how good or how hard you try. So I think, you know, you can be all the advocates you want, but this just sometimes grabs you and takes over, and I think that's the worst. That is just about the worst, so.
And thanks for sharing that with us, June. I know that had to be really hard, and I'm sure we've all had similar situations that we felt just very much there. You know, I tried to do what I could, but it just didn't seem to help the situation. But yet, when you look at that situation, you know that you did help that patient and were supportive to their family. I mean, to even get that patient to that point.
Yeah, I know. But the bottom line, the message involved here is that MS sucks. That's all.
Yes, yes it does.
It so does. It sort of keeps me going. When you get mad enough at it, you just go back and try again. But
no, you're right.
Yeah,
you're right.
That's pretty frustrating.
It is. It's very frustrating.
Yeah. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. Thanks for sharing that with us. Doug, I know there's one more question in the queue.
The next one in queue comes from a line of Jen Smirka. Please proceed with your
okay.
question.
Okay. Hi, Jen.
Hey, it's me again. Sorry.
Okay.
I actually had a question I wanted to ask Willie, and that was during the time of the hurricane, I was just curious if you could share any maybe, you know, obviously natural disasters can occur in all of our practices, but I was just curious if you and maybe Beverly, if there was anything that you had done at that time that obviously you could share that maybe some of us haven't had the experience with as far as advocating for patients, like as far as maybe housing or any other, you know, medicines or anything that you guys did at that time that you could just share as part of your experience of advocating in MS nursing?
Well, during the tornado back in April, we really, our patients were not really affected that much. We did have a patient that lived in one area, and I know she's very disabled. And I called, you know, a few days after to see how they had done. And they fared well. They just had some roof damage and I think some damage to a garage, but they were really not, they really did not have to leave their home. There was another patient that we have. They lost wherever they were living. I don't know if they owned it or they rented it, but their home was blown away, and they were able to walk out of it. The only thing we had to do for that particular person was to just call in extra medications. But, you know, we really didn't have any requests for housing or anything like that because I think, you know, if they were affected, they were able to get what they need without having to call us.
Mm, okay. Well, Jen, you just mentioned disasters. We just had recently several patients that had lost their homes in the fires, which is in this day and age, and it's hard to believe that whole neighborhoods could actually be burned down the way that they were. And as far as the disaster situation, of course, that was all put in place for them. But we did communicate a lot with the patient, with the MS Society, and I have to say that they did step up to the plate, and they did provide the patient, you know, they had lost everything. I mean, everything, their toothbrush, I mean, just wheelchairs, walkers, everything. And they had helped the patients get resupplied with the proper equipment, you know, that they needed. And they were quite quick about it. They really were.
That's great. Yeah, I was just curious, you know, because I think that is also part of, it's not our day-to-day function, obviously. I think of more of kind of the things that Willie had described in her presentation, but I was just curious, and actually it was, you're right, Willie, the tornado, not the hurricane. Sorry, we're just finishing hurricane season in Florida.
Yeah.
And, you know, we during the summer months, we get requests for, you know, statements of diagnosis for, so they can get cooling vests or so they can get an air conditioner or things like that. And, you know, we've had some requests recently for statement of diagnosis. They just say they need a statement. You know, I'm not really sure. You know, the holidays are coming up. I don't know. You know, if they have, some of them need assistance with power issues and things like that.
Well, especially with the cold weather,
mm-hmm.
and of course in the heat, the hot weather. But I think we have time for maybe one more question. If there's anything in the queue.
There is nothing in the queue at this time,
Nothing
Lori.
In the queue. Okay. Well, I think we're just about close to the end here. Willie, thank you so much for your presentation, and thank you, everybody, for calling in and sharing all your experience with us. We really appreciate it. I would like to say on behalf of the IOMSN that thank you. Thank you, Willie, for your presentation. And
thank you.
You again to Biogen IDEC for their support with the unrestricted educational grant. Appreciate you in joining us, and please join us next Tuesday, which is December 20th, and that is for, the topic is Avoiding Burnout in MS Nurses. This is with Connie Easterling, and this is definitely a topic also that so many of us can actually relate to. So I'd like to say goodnight to everybody. This concludes tonight's meeting, and have a nice evening. We'll see you next month.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude today's teleconference. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect your lines at this time, and have a wonderful day.